First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers. I'm Mary Fallett, if there's anyone here who doesn't know me. I'm the vice chair of the verification committee, and full disclosure, we are not a verified center yet. I guess if you're the vice chair of the committee, first of all, you don't want to fail. And second, something keeps coming up that always prevents me from wanting to actually start the application process. And I'd just like to make a couple of remarks. One is that an anesthesiologist is a very essential member of your team, and I'd like to call out Connie Houck, who's in the audience here. Our surgical safety officer is an anesthesiologist. She has one day free every week to devote to this program. And she's really been a detective in terms of sort of spearheading projects and doing a deep dive into the kind of exploratory that you need to recognize where your warts are and what needs to be fixed. A couple of things that weren't mentioned is one is that all of these documents are downloadable from the site. So if you wanted to actually look at them and see what the standards are and what the PRQ says about the different levels of programs, they're available to you so that you can actually look at them and do a gap analysis and ask the staff at the ACS if you have any questions. There's also a frequently asked questions site that's been generated with questions that sites have asked that we clarified, and that's getting to be pretty extensive, and eventually we'll be in version two, and we have a plan for version two, which is going to sort of be a four-year effort or so, and we'll start soon. I wanted to mention the consultation visits again, which will start in January. These are at least at initial intent to be an exploratory, so they're more for sites that are not as much developing a program but are interested in developing a program and doing a gap analysis and need support from us to look at what you have in place and what you might need and to meet with administration and to lobby support for the program. And just a couple of things that we're also, that are in motion is a group of us are going to meet in December, recognizing that we have no verified level in 2 and 3 sites to look at what the challenges are for those sites. We're very interested in having level 2 and 3 sites in this program. And this is, again, sitting down with a group of people who are interested in looking at the challenges and going through the standards and seeing how we might approach them. And we're also going to be developing a process for verifying specialized centers such as cancer centers or freestanding like the Shriner centers where they might have a special emphasis in orthopedics or burns. So we have another strategic session to meet with that group and to develop a process for verification for those types of centers. In terms of privileging, I happen to be part of a system where the Children's Hospital is one of the hospitals, and we actually credential all of the adult surgeons to take care of children, even if they're not working at our hospital, which has created sort of a whole host of questions for me. We have developed a process where if you're a pediatric boarded specialist, there are core privileges that you can apply for, and if you're a provider who does not have pediatric boards, there's a separate process and there's an age limit for individuals who aren't boarded so that we have a two-level system for the application process, which does help a little bit in identifying people who are qualified to take care of different ages of patients. So at this point, I'd like to open it up for questions. There's a microphone over here. If you have a question, if you don't mind, please identify yourself and your institution or your hospital. And we'll be glad to, or if there's a certain panel member you'd like to address it to, you can do that also.
Thank you, Mary, and the panelists. My name is Paul Danielson. I'm at Hopkins All Children's in St. Pete, Florida. We're in the process of wanting to apply for a level 1 verification. And I noticed through all the presentations today, a lot of the emphasis was on sort of internal PI and QI improvement processes and things like that. And, you know, perhaps we are living in a state of sort of ignorant bliss, but we feel like we have that sort of set up. And what the nut that we're trying to crack has to do more with our regional leadership. You know, as a quaternary center, we get hundreds and hundreds of patients transferred in from, you know, scores of hospitals locally, nationally, and internationally. And the process that we don't have is sort of how to provide the feedback to those centers, dealing with the under and over triage. And I didn't hear anyone speak to that specifically today in their comments, and I was wondering if any members of the panel wish to comment on that.
I can start, and then Marlita. So our transport team, sort of the person who does all the QA, comes to our PIPS meetings and gives a report now. And we have had her abstract all of the transports into surgical and medical so that we know what the denominator is and what the numerator is for surgical transports. Since we're a system, we have a lot of inter-facility stuff, and then we have those who come from the outside. So those who are within facilities can look in the medical record to get feedback, but if there's anything specific, there's a team debriefing once the patient gets to our site. And those who are outside, they look at all of those individually for whether there needs to be focused feedback or just if it's a NICU transport, there's always a call back to the provider who sent the patient or to the nursery the next day to give them a report. But there's some type of call so that there's communication between the providers within 24 hours of that transport.
And you document this in the EMR, or you have a PI form or something like that?
There was no documentation, but now they have documentation through their committee. So that process was developed because they weren't really doing much of anything. So now there's a process for that to take place.
Right. Yeah, you know, we've been struggling with this since its inception, because we had a really good process for our trauma transfers, because we're a level one trauma center, so that was part of that system. It's pretty straightforward. But what we're actually doing now is we're building a tool in Epic, whereby once a patient is admitted, because as I'm sure is at every other hospital, who's on call at 2 o'clock in the morning when the patient comes in is different many times than the person who is going to take care of the patient the next day. And so we had to figure out a system whereby Epic would then flag and provide communication to the person who is actually responsible for taking care of the patient so that the communication starts there. And so it is tracked through Epic. Mm-hmm. But it's in the build process. It's not completed yet.
I think this is a real opportunity for us nationally to make a difference, because I don't think that any of us are doing this very well. An example, one of the site visits I did, came across a kid with malrotation with volvulus. In the surgeon's note, he notes that the child had been in one emergency department with green vomiting, sent home with a viral illness, comes back to a second, different emergency department 8 hours later, gets sent in, gets an operation. Fortunately, the bowel's all alive, right? But there's no feedback to that first emergency department. I'm confident that historically, if that happened in our place, exactly the same thing would happen, right? That they would not be notified. And I think one of our burdens is we're a very pediatric-rich, resource-rich environment, and we have a responsibility to figure out a way to educate back. We haven't cracked yet. What we're trying to do is every transfer that comes in, there's now an automated email to the receiving doc to just say, were there issues in the pre-hospital phase? If so, we'll call you. We're still in the phase of just trying to get, if you say yes, we'll call you. And we'll see how that works. It's new for us, and then we're trying to create who we contact back in those hospitals. And our approach is it's gonna have to go medical leadership to medical leadership, because, you know, 12 hours later you call back, that emergency physician has, you know, finished the shift. So you need to have some sort of system-based approach. That's what we're trying to build. So starting within our system, then working out. I think historically everybody's paid pretty close attention to what happens when they're in your helicopter, but before that, outside the trauma system, I think nobody is really addressing it. But it, I think it is a real opportunity for us to make a difference. And really, it's the neurosurgeon that's going to know if there's something that should have been done differently from a neurosurgical standpoint in the emergency department.
So we were one of the pilot sites, and we're still working on our process. And we've got a system very similar to what Dr. Barnhart described. So what you need to know is that if you've got a process that you're working on, even if it's less than perfect, the committee understands that this is new and that we're, as I said at the outset, we're trying to be helpful about that.
Great. And one follow-up question. I'm shocked that Michigan is able to do this with one program manager. I mean, you are, must be superpowers. I was just curious, if we could poll people, how many FTEs do you actually have devoted to this program at different sites? Because my program manager thinks that he can't do it alone, and I tend to agree. 3.
Arlena,
thank you.
Did you want
to? No, we have 3.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to have 3.
So we have me, the medical director. We have the safety officer. We have the NISQIP person, we have a quality, so we've just, one of my other partners, Cynthia Downard, is going to be the surgical quality officer, and that will start in a couple of months. And I keep pounding on the door of the CEO and saying we need more data, which I didn't mention. One of the things at the site visits that comes out over and over again is that there's data that should be available to us that isn't. It's this hidden data on these dashboards that most hospitals have that are restricted to certain staff, and we really need to have access to that data so that it's transparent and we can work with it and we understand what we need to fix. So I just last week discovered that there were these dashboards that they did let our nurse manager get access to. So I want the rest of us to have access to them and the committee to have access to them so we can actually show them in the committee. But I don't know whether you call it clinical effectiveness or QI or, you know, there's a whole data department, I'm sure, at your institution, and they need to devote some effort to your program because that's essential to you moving forward.
When our site visitor team sort of summarized the findings for us, they were pretty clear that our strength was Ashley, but also that was our weakness, you know, because, I mean, she was the link that if something were to happen, that we would be very vulnerable. So, you know, again, I sort of kind of mentioned that we all quickly recognized that Ashley was completely dedicated, and then we try to support, rally around her. But one of the things that I would try to sort of say is that when you talk to the hospital administration about, like, FTEs, I mean, everybody's thinking about, you know, the accounting, how are they going to come up with the money. But I just said that this, it has to be a sustainable kind of thing. And we all have an expiration date. I mean, we're not going to be doing this for 50 years. So, you know, why don't we find someone that actually can mentor and then sort of like kind of sort of make it a continuous process. And so try to how to frame the sort of kind of whole picture so that we can continue to do this in a better way. So, but thank you, Ashley.
Yeah. Just one more key point. Is that working? Oh, there we go. For your program manager, just it absolutely is more than 40 hours a week, and that's just the reality of it, but also engage your allies. So know who those data analysts are that you can pull in. Know who your friends are in the NICU and PICU that can help you do case reviews when they need to. And that's really the key, because the expectation is not that you can do it all. You need your team members, but it's absolutely more than 40 hours a week, and that's how it is, but they can get it done.
I know we're running short on time, but I want to thank you guys for this session, and it really is helpful. The website doesn't answer all the questions. It's really been very, very helpful. Andrea Hayes-Jordan from University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I just wondered if you could expand on the pediatric surgical subspecialty credentialing and availability. As you know, with the smaller hospitals, if you just have two pediatric urologists in our place, as we're preparing to do the application, there's a lot of questions about, you know, how does the credentialing and the call schedule need to look? What is the spirit of the verification for level one? And what is sort of the minimum, if you will, for pediatric surgical subspecialist availability 24/7 and the credentialing process?
Yeah. Thanks for that question. That's come up in several places. I think the outside of pediatric general and thoracic surgery, it's acceptable to have adult coverage is frontline, so that is okay. The requirements that go with that are that you need to have a defined scope of practice, so they can't cover everything. The example comes up in, you know, an example being neurosurgery, that you define prospectively that they'll do shunt revisions, they'll do craniotomies for trauma, they don't see the spina bifida consults. So you need to each, and again, that's not prescriptive from the ACS of what those criteria are, but they do have to be defined prospectively. Your PIPS process then needs to monitor that, and there does need to be a backup schedule, which is the challenge if there's only two. That really means they're on every other night as backup. I think in the places we've looked at, it's acceptable that that backup schedule be only available to the generalists that are covering, right? So it doesn't need to be that everybody in the hospital can get that, but there should be a defined scope of practice of what the generalists will do when they have to call, and then there needs to, in fact, be a backup that they can call.
Okay, so. Yeah. And the backup has to be one of the pediatric surgeons.
Yeah, they have to be a
pediatric
specialist.
Thank you.
See, we have 3 minutes.
So you mentioned, Kevin Moriarty, Bay State in Springfield, Mass., that there's been 11 verified programs and 45 in the process. Any level twos out of the 45?
One, a couple in the process.
And so I think some of the concern people feel that they may not be able to do level one, but they don't want to do level two because then their scope of practice may be limited. And that's what the concern is, I think, of some programs.
So the scope of practice is really a local credentialing thing. So like your scope of practice isn't going to be limited. It's related to the resources that you have available in your hospital to take care of that child. So, and that comes down to anesthesia in many cases. Do you have 24/7 pediatric anesthesia? Do you have the ability to do you have the ability to have your x-rays read? Do you have a pediatric radiologist to come in and do the study? So, you know, I have the feeling there are several centers who are sort of in between ones and twos. They'd rather be a one, but they potentially don't have the administrative support to get what they need to be a one. And perhaps a consultative visit in that type of situation would be helpful. But if you have specific questions, you should send them to us so that we can look at that. And this focus group is going to meet at December 2nd. So if anyone has questions specifically about level twos and threes, we'd love to get them before that task force meets.
And Doug did clarify that you can have a transfer agreement for ECMO and cardiac surgery.
Correct.
Yeah, and we would encourage that. Yeah. We really do not want to have a proliferation of low-volume centers for these complex things.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like to thank everyone for attending.
Right,
it's
9:29.
Yes.
I want to make a plug for the ACS quality and safety meeting that happens over the summer. If you haven't attended, I encourage you to attend. And particularly centers that are in the process of this, some of these difficult nuts to crack. If you figure out how to identify transfers and issues and communicate back, I mean, we would love to see abstracts on that and posters. And it doesn't have to be a perfect process. We're all on this journey. If you've got ideas that are working, please put them into those meetings so that we can share each other's experiences. So again, it's a great meeting. It's really moved from being a NISQIP meeting to being a broader surgery quality and safety. And if you're interested in this stuff, that meeting fits in great, and we'd love to see your ideas there. Sorry.
It's all right. Thank you, everybody.